We should go ahead and get started. Welcome to Church History in a New Building. So this will be nice, a little bit more close and less quiet or less noisy when the heat's on. Believe it or not, the heat is on full tilt right now, and that's as loud as it gets.
Really?
Yeah. So that's nice. That's true. Tonight, we are going to work through what is typically referred to as the Golden Age of Medieval Christianity. Obviously, that's making a statement about several different things. Whenever you talk about the Golden Age of something, you talk about leaps in either in invention or in, especially when you're talking about an empire, whether it's borders or it's rulers or something happened that's so notable that it really sets it apart from other sections, or it sets off a time period that brings in so many different things. And when you're talking about it for a church, it's really difficult to say what the golden age of a church is. You know, how do you even define that? And the reality is, when you're dealing with a cultural church like Western Roman Catholicism, it carries the same structure as it does with every empire. It has its difficult centuries, and it has its golden centuries, and then it has its declines, its attempts at reformations, things like this. And the Roman Catholic Church, being first Roman and then a church, the reality is it follows many different of the ebbs and flows of every empire. And so when we refer to golden age of medieval Christianity, what you're usually going to be focused on is about the 11 and 1200s. And so if you're ever looking that up, that's when there was all of these redesigns of architecture, these flourishes of expansion for them, crusades. There was a number of changes with regards to the relationship that the Pope and the papacy had with empires and the kings of the world. All of these things changed during this time period and brought about significant leaps and bounds for at least the power and the authority of the Western Roman Catholic Church. So when I'm talking about it this way, we are going to be going forward focused mainly on the Western Church. The Eastern Church at this point is actually quite weak. There's really very little going on as far as for development or as far as for interactions. You will find that not only is the Eastern Church pretty much stagnant, but so is the entire Eastern Empire being called into question. Even during this time, by the way, the Fourth Crusade, if you can actually set them apart like that, one of the Crusades, did not go where they were intending to go and instead took a bypass and went to Constantinople, the empire's headquarters of the Eastern Empire, and took it over. They laid siege to Constantinople and took it, and you have for a spat of time a Latin empire ruling the Eastern Greek Empire, which is just kind of some bizarre stuff that happens at this time. So things like that are occurring because the East is really dealing with the ramifications of constantly having to hold off Islamic invasions and constantly having to deal with things in country, both from the north and from the southeast. The reality puts it is most of the discussion regarding the changes in church history have to take place in the West because that's where things are exploding. That's where everything's going. That's where all the development is going on. That's where the relationship between church and state is starting to get defined. And at the beginning here, you're going to find a lot more power goes into the church in the 12th century than in any other century except the 4th. The 4th century with Constantine, that one kind of inarguably, the linkage of state and church was undeniable. And when you get, however, up to the 1100s with people like Pope Innocent III, the 1100s, and then all going into the 1200s, you get a papacy that affects the state in ways that are almost immeasurable. If the state imposed its right and ability and power onto the church under Constantine, it is here in the early 1200s, late 1100s, that you get the church imposing itself on all the states of Europe. And so you will not have a single king or a single ruler that's sitting on a throne that did not have the sign-off of the papacy. in the early 1200s. That's how significant it got. And it got, well, as you can imagine, pretty rough, pretty quick. And so we're going to talk about some of that. Some of the other things we're going to talk about are the cultural changes that brought about a different approach of the church to the culture. And that doesn't always come in the form of extreme authority and hierarchy, such as in the papacy. A lot of it is determined by monks. Monasticism, trying to interact with a changing Europe, all of a sudden led to a fractional concept of how all sorts of ministry is done, a concept of how priests interact with people, about how the papacy is actually understood, and how bishops have certain responsibilities now, especially as currency starts coming into Europe, and it's going to change everything. We're going to walk through a lot of that tonight. So I don't know if you've ever heard of the Franciscan monks or the Dominican monks or the Waldensians. These are some of the people we're going to talk about tonight. Innocent III, strongest pope in all of history. It's not even close. We're going to talk about him because you just can't, they can't talk about the strength of the papacy without talking about Innocent III, one of the strangest names guys ever. And then if we have time, I don't know how that's going to work. If we have time, we're going to delve a little bit into Scholasticism and Thomas Aquinas, because that is usually I have an entire hour lecture on him by myself, but I may just introduce him, and then we'll return back to that next week, because Scholasticism is another one of the leaps and bounds that the Western Church takes at this time period. When I say monk, what do you typically think? Like, what comes to mind? It's okay if it's, Friar Tuck, for instance, from
Cowled Robes.
Yeah.
Monastery. Bent over illuminated manuscripts.
Yeah. Yeah. Bent over illuminated. You said very strict. And a lot of praying, correct. Anything else?
A lot of brewing.
Later history, especially when German monks get involved, absolutely. They developed some of the best beer recipes in history. In fact, nothing regarding brewing or chocolate, for instance, would ever be as it is without monasteries. That's right. But that's a little bit later in history. You usually think of monks as very well off, very poor, or kind of middle of the road, or reflective of the culture in which they live. Poor. Yeah, you know why? From this time period, right here. Before this, there were exceptions to the, we're going to live in a monastery and everyone's going to pray, or they're going to pay for us to pray for them, and monasteries started getting very wealthy. We've walked through some of that. You had reactions against that for those that we called anchoritic monastics, those who would go and live in the desert by themselves. They'd just be like, forget all worldly treasures. I want nothing. I don't even want family. I don't want interaction. I don't want temptation. I don't want anything. I'm going to go live in the desert. St. Anthony, we spent an entire evening talking about him as one of the examples of that. Anchoritic monasticism has been around for many, many, many centuries. It really isn't until this time period, when we're talking about the late 1100s, the early 1200s, where you start getting this idea that There is a vow to poverty, and poverty is not only next to godliness, it is the path of godliness. That's a whole other aspect. With early monasticism, you will get poverty is a way to not distract me from spiritual duties, right? That's how St. Anthony would put something like that, and he would be late 300s, right? But as you're coming to a time like this, what you're going to start seeing is with the rise of currencies, with the rise of predictable ability to bring currency and monetary policy to bear inside the Holy Roman Empire, what's going to change about that is no longer is Europe going to be the kind of barter economy it largely was for about 600 years since the fall of the Western Empire. Now, we might look at that and go, how much is that actually going to change in church history? Well, that's going to change a lot of the church. If you think about it, if you go from a barter economy, where if you're bartering for something, Linda, let's say that you trap squirrels, right? And you sell squirrel pelts, which were actually a pretty good commodity at the time. You could make socks, you could make hats, gloves, things like this, right? Now, you can have all the squirrel pelts in the world, but that's not going to really feed you, right? So most of the people would be growing food, grains, or having livestock, right? You're not going to eat squirrels. That's not going to happen. So you're going to use them for their fur, and then you're going to use that fur to hopefully go, maybe Terry, maybe you have some cows, right? Bernie, maybe you grow wheat, right? And so what you're going to do is hope that they need some fur because you need some wheat. It's a very inefficient way for culture to work, but it's built on a very small, all in a single valley, never travel outside 5 miles from here type culture. And we don't trust coinage from anywhere else because who knows what that metal is. We're not going to trust their authority, that authority. Who cares? There's a unification that's coming to Europe, though, where currencies start to become the way of it. And it actually morphs what is largely a barter economy into a currency economy, what we would be much more familiar with. You okay? All right. That's going to change a lot of things. How monasteries used to get wealthy was people would, in their wills, donate land to the monastery so that these monks would continue to pray for them so that they can get out of purgatory earlier. You can understand how bad theology can make things worse and worse and worse. This happens even when people are alive. This happens for the sake of their grandparents. All sorts of things go on. And monasteries and the church gained so much of the land that these things became massive problems. Well, when monetary systems come in that are more state-backed currencies, we do see a significant shift, a shift in population. And we don't talk about history that much here. We try to keep it to church history. But one of the things that money does is it makes cities appear. You don't have cities without currency. And also, you don't typically have currency without cities closely following behind it. This is one of the things that made Europe what it became. What used to be little hamlets and things like this, all of a sudden, a city would become a huge pull to those who were living in these smaller towns. And there was a way that you could move from being a squirrel catcher to doing something else in the city if you were able to sell enough furs in order to bring about enough money in order to purchase something inside a city. It was no longer dependent solely on what your parents did or what your grandparents did or the family farm or something like this. It actually enabled cities to develop. And that's what currency has a lot of effect on. There's a lot of other things that affect that, but money always changes living conditions when it comes into an economy that's used to bartering. That's also going to change monastic concept. The monastic world had always been based on this idea of service to God. Pretty much it was based exclusively in the 4th century when it first began on this idea that we will suffer for God. It wasn't even directly connected to the idea of poverty or anything like that. That was just a natural outflow. All right. If Christianity, which for the first 250 years developed under abject persecution, sometimes extreme, sometimes not, sometimes everywhere, sometimes localized, but Christianity largely for the first 250 years developed under a concept of suffering, persecution. And then all of a sudden when Constantine comes in and the church is not only legal, but then within two generations is made the state religion, all of a sudden it is impossible to suffer as a Christian. In fact, it is beneficial for you in the society to become a Christian. A lot of people did not know how to deal with that. We talked about this with the rise of monasticism in the 4th century because monasticism was a way to pull back from the culture so that we can suffer as we ought. Right. These days we talk about, you know, want to be involved in the culture, but then the culture hates us and we immediately pull back because we don't like the suffering. We pull back for comfort. We're doing the exact opposite of the original monastic movement. They would love it if the culture started persecuting them because that's where the state of Christian theology was at the time. But as we come to the 11th and 12th century, not only is it popular to be a Christian, we're getting very close to Christendom. If you are German, you are a Christian just because you are so by birth. Spanish, you're super Christian. All of this kind of stuff is about to drop down into the European mindset. So how do monasteries respond to all of this? Now, instead of somebody dying and giving their land, they can just sell their land and they can just give you money. They can actually just start hiring people, or they can just start using cash directly to affect such things. Give rise to three different people that gave rise to three different very significant groups of people to follow them. These three people, I will give them to you not in any specific order of birth or anything like that, but they're all about the same generation. Peter Waldo of Lyon, from France. Another name you probably have heard before, St. Francis of Assisi, who the current Pope named himself after. By the way, that tells you a little bit about him, or at least what he wants you to think about him. Not making any calls, just saying. And St. Dominic. These three guys will affect a great deal of concepts about how it is to be a monk in Europe. And they will all have their ministries and their monastic way all at the end of the 1100s, the beginning of the 1200s. This is what I mean when I say this is a shift in kind, a shift in time and of culture. It is not primarily a shift in theology. It is a shift in culture, and theology is attempting to interact with it. Culture was changing dramatically. You have wealth that is starting to outpace what anyone could possibly use. It used to be that you could have enough land and then you could hire enough people, right? The whole concept of feudalism. They could have part of it. They would land. You would have a whole hierarchy of structure. This is one of the things that currency starts doing away with, is this concept of feudalism. But that concept of feudalism had led to the church being wealthy in very specific ways. Now it's leading to a whole other way of thinking. These three are not connected with each other, but they are doing very much the same thing in different places. And together they are called and referred to as beginning the mendicant orders. If you are interested in monasticism, that's an important term, mendicant, M-E-N-D-I-C-A-N-T, the mendicant orders. Literally, it just comes from the Latin term to beg. They started developing a theology of poverty as a virtue. Poverty is not just a descriptor, but it is better than wealth. It is more virtuous to be poor than it is to be wealthy. Now, we kind of look at that and we're like, yeah, we've seen teaching like that and so forth. Well, it's not really largely been an issue with regards to these things. Poverty was just kind of one of those things that, I guess it was more of a given, right? If you're going to go live in the desert, what's money going to do for you? It was just kind of one of those bypass ways. But it was an attempt to suffer. It wasn't really a focus on money specifically. Now it becomes a significant focus on money. When I say significant, I mean they would refer to themselves as preachers of poverty. And so you're not talking about going out and just, well, I don't want money to be a distraction for me. It's money is akin to sin. Money becomes the root of all kinds of evil. In the monastic concept, at least as we go through some of these, you're going to see some of that develop out. Now, they would be way on the understanding that asceticism, severity to the body of sorts, would be a high ideal for a Christian person, right? Asceticism, if you're unaware, is something that's always been a part of monastic tradition. This one was specifically applied towards poverty, but asceticism is this idea of depriving yourself of something in order to gain spiritual enlightenment or value or virtue. And so, like, for instance, if I go, I mean, let's put it this way. Any monk in history that looked at this building would call all of us heretics. You have so much comfort here, it is impossible to serve God here. You got to understand how deep this goes. Because this would be, you're not preaching the gospel, oh, and by the way, you might also want to give up some money. No, no, no. We preach poverty and sacrament. You must be poor in order to follow Christ. To follow Christ rich is not to follow Christ. You have to understand how significant this is. Yes, ma'am. That's a really good question, and the answer is yes, they grew side by side and often interacted with each other. Right, because Gnosticism holds to a strict duality, physical bad, spiritual good, right? And so when it comes to preaching poverty, there's a lot of overtones to this. Now, they don't go as far as to say physical bad, because they're going to interact with nature, they're going to interact with growing things and stuff like that, but only insofar as it's part of God's creation. But money is that part of the physical world that's totally bad. And all of these guys aren't identical, but some of them will definitely go to that extreme, almost to the point of Gnosticism, yes. That's a great connection. So let's start with Peter Waldo. Peter Waldo lived 1140 to 1205. That's only if you just want, those types of things you can always look up, but I'm just trying to get us settled. He was a wealthy merchant, and he gave up all of his worldly possessions. Eventually began teaching of, this is an important phrase, perfection through poverty. He lived a life of poverty and of preaching. That is how he would refer to it. So much so that the Archbishop of Lyon, where he was from, thought his preaching would insult the rich, and that's not going to work so well for the church, is it? And then actually thus charged him. They even took their issue to Rome on appeal. That did not work out for Peter Waldo very well. The papacy, while it was not at its full strength yet, was getting there pretty quick. They condemned his specific frame of teaching, if you will, but not before he amassed a significant amount of followers called the Waldensians. You know, it's Peter Waldo, Waldensians, that's kind of how it goes. And instead, they were kicked out of Lyon in France, and they went to the remote sections of the Alps and remained there, actually, as an enclave until the Protestant Reformation some 350 years later. This is a fascinating little side history that most people aren't aware of. When the Waldensians went to live in the Alps and kind of built a society around the concept of perfection through poverty, they insulated themselves from some of the craziest parts of medieval Catholic theology by doing this, by being outcasts. And when the Protestant Reformation came to their little town, they all became Protestants. It is a really interesting little side story. If you ever want to read the history of the Waldensians, it's a really fascinating little thing. And they kept to a lot of this for several hundred years on their own. But it's a really fascinating aspect because the Catholic Church, excising them to kind of the mountainous regions where the Protestant Reformation would actually kind of come from. Southern Germany and Switzerland, Geneva, all those kind of areas were kind of their neighborhood. So it's a really interesting story anyway. Peter Waldo does not actually make a specific order of monks, so you don't really see, you know, Waldensian monks. It doesn't really exist like that. They became Protestants and kind of effervesced into the Protestant Reformation. These next two guys, however, do. St. Francis of Assisi, what I call the Italian version of Peter Waldo, but not as, while he is very extreme, he is not as anti-Catholic as he would be. St. Francis of Assisi, born 1181, dies 1226, which if you're good at math, you know he's about 45 years old when he dies. No, not very old at all. Italian version of Peter Waldo, obviously, with a name like that. He became the founder of, I know it's hard to believe, but St. Francis becomes the founder of the Franciscans, the Franciscan order of monks, devoted to, when I say extreme poverty, that's even by monastic standards. when asked once if his followers should have a psalter for the worship time, he said, well, if they're going to have a psalter, next they're going to request this book, and next they're going to request that book. So, no. Nobody gets anything, and you're going to actually learn these things by memory, because otherwise worldly possessions are going to take you alive. You see what I mean when it comes to defining possessions or wealth or anything in terms of sin? It's kind of like if someone came up to you and goes, you know, Bernie, how much stealing is okay for me as a Christian? What's your answer? None. If you're going to steal one thing and get away with it, what's that going to do tomorrow? That's going to embolden you to steal two things and then five. And then that's the level that they're talking about it in the Franciscan order. It's not just a vow of poverty, like I'm not going to be ruled by money. It is I'm not going to have money. Now, this is one of the interesting parts, because his story, he actually also comes from a wealthy family as well. One of the things that happens is his parents do not approve of this. We did not raise you to just go be, literally, mendicant means begging, a bold beggar. We are going to only live off of those things that people give us while we are preaching poverty. And his parents are like, that's not how this is going to go. And his father keeps trying to give him money. Every single time he gives him money, he gives away everything, including clothing, including anything. I will have absolutely nothing. Extreme poverty. One of the things that is really definitive of the Franciscans in the early days is because of extreme poverty, you do not have things like books. There is no encouragement of study or any such thing like that that you would probably associate with other monks. This would be essentially, you are defined by not having things. So, like, for instance, he was accounted as saying, as walking down the street with a huge smile on his face, and someone comes up to him and says, why are you so happy? And he says, because I have married. And the question comes back, well, to whom have you married? And he says, Lady Poverty. This is how deep this is. And this is how much it defines the Franciscan order of monks. Success in all of its forms was the enemy. Wealth is on par with sin. Right? So let me put it in terms. This is the exact opposite of American Christianity. Neither are the gospel. We do not serve Christ by having successful churches and successful lives. That's not how it works. Lots of money does not serve Christ. Little money does not serve Christ. Only a contrite heart, right? And this is one of those aspects of Christian history that we're trying to wrap our heads around, because we're from a completely different society. We do not see this as virtue. Some parts of it are, some parts of it are not. And one could imagine that the vices do not equal the virtue, because every time you go extreme in one area, it overtakes another area. And that's kind of one of the things we see.
So the Christian teachings
are just the pages of world history teaching? Right. So at this point, the average monk would not be interacting with the scriptures. Priests, maybe. Bishops, yes. The average person, though, is attending Latin Mass, and Latin is a nearly dead language at this point. So there is no real depth of this. When you're talking about awareness of how much of the biblical story, it would be very little, mostly relegated to the gospel narratives, not teaching. The gospel narratives, because the whole point was to establish familiarity, especially with the Holy Land. This is kind of in the middle of the Crusades, and so you're getting relics dumped back into Europe that connect you with narrative elements of the story. So, I mean, that was the way of it. What you heard people talking about was that, but. You know, we're kind of associating going to church or going to Mass with coming and hearing the Word of God talked about. That's not happening. They're coming to Mass at this point transubstantiation in about 10, 15 years is about to be ruled the straight up orthodox way of all things. So, I mean, that's the world we're in right here. And so we're not really talking about a time, you know, going in and learning. You know, even when people look at stained glass windows, they're like, oh, they're just learning the Bible stories through the stained glass. No, no, that's not what's happening. Nobody's learning anything. That's just not. What's that? Right. You're coming here for miracles. And Christian life is lived out by just existing. It's kind of like saying in our culture, we don't fill our minds with what makes us an American. Do you? You know, we just don't even ask the question. That's not even occurring. You just be like, I was born here. That's just how it works. Except in the unusual occurrence where somebody was born somewhere else and they went through a naturalization thing. Okay, those are a little strange. You know, we can account for that when it comes to, you know, one of the Moors coming up and coming to follow Christ, or a random, you know, thing in the North Country, you know, someone coming down or something like this. But there's not a lot of travel happening at this time. There's not a lot of expansion happening at this time. And so you're getting to the place where you're just like, wouldn't somebody just ask a question or do this? But the problem is there's no real language or even place to ask questions about what did the scriptures teach. It got so significantly bad that in Germany, right before the Protestant Reformation, someone like Martin Luther, who is an Augustinian monk, very related to the Dominican monks, as an Augustinian monk, he did not even read any of the New Testament until he was getting his doctorate in theology. Okay? So master's degrees in theology and divinity, all this kind of stuff, never, ever, ever read the scriptures. Okay? So that's how far it's going to get. And this is why there's really no holdbacks, because at the end of the day, what is the force in the church that pulls us back to Christ? It's not me. It's not you. It's not our chairs or our building or our tapestries or our architecture. It's not our concept of history or theology or any such thing, or even our practice or our giving up money. It's the scriptures. When the church does not have the scriptures, it's a field day. You can do just about anything. All you have to do is pull a council together and you can determine theology. What's that? Yes, it is a cult. Yes. What is it called? I can't even think of the word. Why am I having a hard time thinking of the word? It's continent. That's the word. It's a continent-wide cult. I don't know why. Continent-wide cult. Yes.
Level, you know,
yep.
From day to day.
Right. Yeah. Right. And when you live in a culture like that, you know, you don't just sit here and go, I don't know, is Christianity right? That's as ludicrous as asking, is this king the one I really want to vote for? Nobody's asking this. That's not how it works. Yeah, this is the way it is. And if somebody would ask a question, that's just the answer that would come. You having an opinion about who should be king is as stupid as you having an opinion about whether the sun should rise tomorrow. Ain't nobody talking about should it. It is, and that is the way of it. Same with the church. We don't like the Pope. That's your Pope. Yes, we're getting there, almost to that, but we're getting there. Christendom has to jump forward several leaps before we're really there. Right now, it's kind of our king has a good relationship with the Pope, and so, yes, we're on good terms with the church, therefore, we get sacraments. All right, so there's not even this, I have an identity as a Christian. Nobody's really even talking about that. It's, do we have the connection to the current Pope so that we can get grace? Right. And so you want to support the Pope. Why? Because that's where God sends his grace through. And if I'm not connected to the Pope, what hope do I have? What am I going to go start a church somewhere like a lunatic?
But
no.
Your king is the mediator.
Sometimes, yes. Your bishop technically is. But this is one of the things that's happening back and forth, is there's two completely different spheres of authority that I'm supposed to interact with. Sometimes I have to interact with and pay my taxes to the king. Nobody likes that day, but everybody's going to do it. You kind of lose really important stuff if you don't. On the other side, I have an eternal soul to concern myself with. I have less time in purgatory to concern myself with. And so I also need to go over here for grace. And that's coming from the Pope. And so what happens when they are arguing or when they have a disagreement? You're going to be taken for a ride. And who knows what becomes of it? This may be a dispute that takes 100 years to figure out, and your great-grandchildren might be able to enjoy a life under the sun, but it's over for you. I mean, and that's just the way of it. There's nothing you can do. Unless you want to go on crusade. Then you don't have to worry about your king, because you're not in the land anymore. And you have salvation procured for you. What a great recruitment strategy. What an amazing thing. And people can pay your way. That's one of the things we're going to discuss at the Fourth Lateran Council soon. Because they had to put a cap on how many relics were coming back. And they finally had to outlaw any relics coming back that did not have papal authority attached to them. Because so many things were flooding to Europe and nothing was being really checked. Because it's never been that significant of an influx before. You know, before it was like, oh, we got a staff here, we got an arrow there, some things here and that and whatnot. Now it's just a flood. And so the Fourth Lateran Council here in 1216 is actually going to put a cap on that exact issue because it became an overwhelming problem. Let's... Sure. Yep.
So, well, again, talking about relics. I mean, relics, he had no interest in relics. As possessions.
Not as possessions. No.
He recognized the spiritual value.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely.
And having nothing, I mean, I don't mean to be thick about this, but he's not walking around naked.
Some of them were.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of the most extreme ones were.
Truly nothing.
Okay, so the most modest ones would have a single tunic that they wore all the time, and that's it. And some of them, even in the wintertime, which you got to understand, Europe.
Yep. Yes.
We're talking extreme poverty. These are the nutcases, all right?
Okay. No books, no studies. So how does transit interact with other Christians? Is it... We're not teaching. Is it just this is the best spiritual way to be?
Yeah. So he initially, not many people received him very well at all. He did eventually get approval to start an order of monasteries, an order of monasticism, and that's why there's an official Franciscan order of monks. It was a little bit rough in coming. Because his teachings were really significantly extreme and very different than anything that before. So it did take a while for it to kind of catch on, but initially some of the reaction of it was kind of dismissive and almost derisionary. But you can't hold back a flood like that for very long. Either you're going to have to condemn them as heretics or you're going to have to accept them as an alternate form of Christianity living. And with the Waldensians, Rome condemned them as heretics. With the Franciscans, they accepted them as their own kind of strange cousin. How's that? And it really does become kind of a parallel version of Catholicism. So for all of the talk of a singular church and a singular theology, that would straight up dismiss the Franciscans and the Dominicans, which really go on to develop their own philosophy, theology, very similar to just another denomination inside the Catholic faith. And so you will get things that are just completely different from them. Same thing happened with the Jesuits as well, but they're much more controlled by the papacy than either of these two are. I know from St. Francis, some of the frustrations for him was trying to get people to understand the severity of wealth and success in this world. And that's really hard when the Catholic Church is becoming wealthier and wealthier, but it also depends on very wealthy people. So the reactions to him were pretty disparate. Some hated how hurtful he is to what we're trying to do here. And I think in good conscience, whether that's, you know, right or wrong is a whole nother discussion, but I don't think they're coming up going, man, he's really just harshing on us. We really just want all this money. I'm not looking at most of the, you know, at least in good conscience, church leaders looking at it that way. It's just more of the practical effects of what he's saying. If you're going to talk about how, you know, poverty is the ultimate goal here and wealth is akin to sin, how does that work for our bishop who lives in one of the nicest houses in town? What's that going to do in people's minds? Now, again, they're not going to go, oh, we'll throw out the bishop. They can't do that. But it can make life hard for everyone. And if there's anything that leaders in situations like this are susceptible to, it's a significant amount of pride. And if everyone thinks poorly of them because they're wealthy, that really, who's out there preaching? That's really annoying me. That kind of frustration.
It's something to say, yeah, I may have all this stuff, but I'm taking care of poor St. Francis.
Yes, yes. That made it a lot easier when it became a legitimate order of monks rather than just a legitimate Christian alternate way of life. I, as a bishop, for instance, I don't have to live like Francis of Assisi or any of the Franciscans. I'm not a Franciscan monk. Perfectly legit to have that parallel thing. Now that doesn't look badly on me, but in the beginning it was really kind of rough because it wasn't an approved order yet. Yeah. I will say that Peter Waldo attempted to make his own order of monks as well and was turned down by the papacy because he said he looked like it and smelled like a pig. So that's always fun. Let's go to St. Dominic, born 1170, died 1221. Again, 51 years old when he dies. 1170 to 1221. He was born to an aristocratic family, so political ties, wealth ties, all sorts of stuff. He also was turned down by the Pope to found a new order of monks, right? He was attempting to found a monastic order that was focused on disciplines, study, and the refutation of heresies. Now, this is an interesting facet because this is completely different than the Franciscans. The Franciscans are laser focused on poverty and basically nothing else. I mean, really, if you're laser focused on poverty, you don't have the ability to be focused on anything else, so that's just what you are. The Dominicans, St. Dominic, has a completely different way about this. One, he is well studied, so he has real high ideals when it comes to studying things. In order to study things, you need some level of funding, some kind of money, unless student loans exist. You know, you need to actually develop some way in order to have books, in order to hire somebody to teach you to read or to interact with languages long gone. And so because of this, he had this opinion that there was no actual order of monks that was specifically suited to his preferences for this. He asked the Pope for approval to found a new order, and again, he was turned down, at least initially, and was told that the Augustinian order of monks was sufficient for what they were looking for. We're not going to make any more monastic orders. And so what they ended up doing was taking the Augustinian order of monks and adapting it to their life. And so you will get what will in effect be the Dominican monks. They will take the Augustinian, and they're much more closely to that. The Augustinian order of monks is also devoted to study and some of the other things, but they have a different set of disciplines. They're from a different century, and so that makes perfect sense. It wasn't until later on that the Dominican monasteries took on this concept of poverty on top of the study and everything else. Mendicancy was something that they had later on. And that's one of the biggest definers, between Franciscans and Dominicans going forward. It won't come up very often, but it is important to point out, poverty, think Franciscan monks. Study, and then poverty, think Dominicans. That's pretty much how you can structure that out. They both had significant discipline codes and all that kind of stuff. So who's the Pope that's turning down all this stuff and approving these orders and imposing wills on things and so forth? Enter the most significant Pope in all of history, Innocent III. He serves as Pope for 18 years. He becomes Pope at 37, dies at 55. The years that he is in the office is 1198 through 1216, which if you're keeping track of the time, that overlaps with everyone that we've been talking about tonight. He becomes the most powerful Pope in history, and it's not overly close. He has a specific way about him and a specific leadership technique and grasp of geopolitical happenings, the power of the church, the relationship between the state and the church and how these things work. And he's also a political whiz when it comes to forcing kings to do things. It's a study in how an almost perfect narcissist can turn the course of church history. It's a remarkable thing to watch. There was, at the same time, rising up a kind of a concept of democratization and the creations of small little republics, little federalized cities that monitored and ran themselves. That becomes challenges to, obviously, the king's authorities and things like this. One of the things that made Innocent III so great is he was able to spin really inconvenient things like that into a way to gain more power for the church. There is really, I don't know if there's a single instance in his papacy where the papacy actually lost power at all. Like, any option that there was to gain control over anything, I don't care if it was Germany, Bohemia, France, Spain, Italy, England. Let me give you an example from England. Let me read this little story snippet, just to give you an idea of how he pulled things off. Pope Innocent III and John of England, who was the brother of Richard the Lionheart, again, this is right during the Crusades, they clashed over the question of who was the legitimate Archbishop of Canterbury. There were two rival claimants to that throne, which was the most important bishopric in all of England. And both of those candidates and claimants appealed to the Pope. Pope Innocent's response was that neither was the legitimate archbishop. Instead, he named another one to that post. The king, John, refused to accept the papal decision, and Innocent excommunicated the king. When this proved insufficient, Innocent declared John deposed from his throne, watch this, released all of his subjects from their vows of obedience to him, and called a crusade against him. I mean, you want to talk about three steps in. This was to be under the leadership, so he goes to his friend in France, Philip Augustus of France, who gladly wanted to obey and please the Pope in this manner, because any time that France gives a chance to invade England is a wonderful thing, and to have the Pope pay for it, I mean, it is Christmas in France. And so they're going to go into this. He gladly prepared to obey the Pope in this manner, fearing that many of his subjects were not loyal to him. John feared that he would not be able to defend his throne, eventually capitulated, and made his entire kingdom a fief of the papacy. That is how you do geopolitics in the 1200s. How long did that last? That's a good question. I do not know the answer to that question. It was not short. And there's still remnants of it all the way up to the English Reformation, when Henry VIII finally told the Pope to just take a hike. So this kind of stuff happens everywhere. That's just one example. There's dozens. He was only Pope for 18 years, and he did this kind of stuff like it was every Saturday morning. And it doesn't matter if it was the same thing happened in Sicily, for instance, where the king actually devoted all of Sicily to the papal throne as one of its papal states. And so you're talking about an overlap of state and church authority. And let me give you a quote from Innocent, because he talks about how he sees these two things, because he sees that there is definitive roles of authority that God has given, one to the papacy, the church, the ecclesiastical authority, and then to the state, the kingly empire, imperial authority, right? Listen to how he describes them. We're going to have church over here, we'll have state over here. He says, just as God established two great luminaries in the heavens, the greater to preside over the days and the lesser to preside over the nights, so did he establish two luminaries in the heavens of the universal church, the greater, the church, to preside over souls as over days, and the lesser to preside over bodies. You see that same separation you get as over nights. These are pontifical authority. Notice he doesn't say ecclesiastical. He doesn't say the church. It's pontiff, the pope, and royal power. So he's saying, kings, you're like the moon. Completely worthless without me. I am the sun. I am the primary. There's two, yes. But without me, you're nothing. And you don't have anything. And by the way, I can appoint everyone. And if you're not going to support me, we have an army. And if you're not going to support me, guess what? I got 20 other kings that would love to support me, and your land will become theirs. It is such a significant amount of power that pours into the papal office in the early 1200s because of this man. And he uses his natural concept of how to do these things to override everything. The Pope, as he determined, and as people were just kind of hushedly, without much choice, agreeing, the Pope, he says, has the authority to appoint emperors, since both powers come from God. The pontifical authority and the royal throne both come from God. I have the ability to appoint even emperors, which totally didn't cause civil wars. Yeah, it caused some civil wars. One of the things that he does is, not only are we going to solve the political problems of the Pope not getting his way everywhere in the world, we're going to solve the theological problems. He calls the Fourth Lateran Council, which is also called Innocent's wish list that gets rubber stamped, is what I call it. The Fourth Lateran Council, 1215, 1216, I forget exactly which one off the top of my head. Let me give you a rundown of what they were taking up there. Now, the Fourth Lateran Council only met over the course of 3 days. Three one-day councils. That's not how theology has ever worked, unless you're coming to just go, what is it the Pope wants us to do? Okay. Ka-chink. So listen to this list of things that they worked on. One, to fully realize the doctrine of transubstantiation, defined, spelled out, canonized. Transubstantiation, when you come to the altar, the relics inside work a miracle onto the bread and the cup. They become the literal body, the physical body and physical blood of Christ, who is broken and offered and shed and sacrificed anew every single Mass everywhere in the world. That doctrine becomes fully realized there at the Fourth Lateran Council. He gave bishops the authority of inquiry, which later becomes the word inquisition, of heresy in all of their domains, and the ability to appeal to Rome for such things. He also, now I say the Fourth Lateran Council did this. These were all of Pope Innocent's ideas, and every one of them passed. So I'm going to say he wants this, because that's really how the papacy worked at that point. He also had no new monastic orders were allowed. We're not going to make any more. So we made the Franciscans, the Dominicans, kind of skirted under as a version of the Augustinian order. But so many people were coming in and attempting to make new orders We already have Benedictine monks. We already have Augustinian monks. We already have Franciscans. And Dominicans are having their own kind of pretend version of it. No more. He furthermore said every cathedral was to have a school, especially for the poor. Sounds nice. All clergy are to abstain from the theater, from games, from hunting, etc. Basically anything fun. That's unfortunate. The faithful must confess their sins. I can repeat any of these if you're trying to write this all down. The faithful must confess their sins and receive communion at least once per year. A good positive one, priests cannot charge for sacraments. That's a good thing. I will say that one has kind of lived on even in my own. I don't actually have charge sheets for things like funerals and weddings. I do them for free, and if somebody wants to give something for that, that's up to them. I don't charge for anything, and it kind of comes from the same time period, right? Now, two that are a little bit more interesting. New relics need full papal approval, personally. Archbishops can't do this. The cardinals can't do this. Only the Pope can approve new relics. And the last one. All Jews and Muslims in Christian lands must wear distinctive clothing. Christian lands. Do you hear that language? That's changing, isn't it? It's changing kind of the concept that there is a separation of church and state. There really isn't. And going forward, it's going to become less and less and less. And the role of the Pope really is going to be more of the pastor of all of Europe and going to impose a will that none can really fight against. Until a little bit later on. All of these things come down to the church as a way to bring all of the church into a singular rulership. It is as close as the church in the West ever got to having a singular leader and a singular Christendom. And that is by rule of law as well as by threat of excommunication. Not only does this happen for England and Germany and France, but everywhere. And this is one of those things that really comes in and changes the approach of everything. And one of the steps here in using a council to bolster papal authority has an unforeseen consequence. Something that starts brewing in people's minds. I mentioned earlier that there was a rise in movements for democratization of smaller towns and little tiny republics and things like this. A city-state that kind of separates itself off from the emperor and tries to become self-ruling happens a lot in Switzerland. That comes into the church, too. If you're familiar with your English history, and if you're familiar with kind of the breakdown of things like democracy coming back into the monarchy-ruled areas of the world, 1215 is an important date in your mind, isn't it? The signing of the Magna Carta. That's during Innocent III's reign. This kind of stuff, and by the way, that was against the king. And so how do you think they got the Pope to agree? Well, what had the Pope already done to the king? That kind of stuff is all happening as well. And so there is becoming this kind of air of there needs to be checks and balances on the kings. Wait a second, there should probably be checks and balances on the ultimate spiritual king, the Pope, right? What is the check or balance on the Pope? Well, in the early 1200s, there isn't one. Not even kings and emperors can be a check or a balance on the Pope. What continues on, though, is when the Pope is using what has been long the way of determining official doctrine, that is the councils, there's a rise in what will be called conciliarism, which is just council with iriism on the back. The idea that who is actually in charge of the church, the Pope or councils? Who corrects who? And believe it or not, that becomes a huge discussion in the 13 and 1400s because we start getting the ever-present problem and risk of multiple popes. That happens several times, and the only way to solve it is councils. And so you can imagine in a world that's in the 1440s gets the printing press, and you start getting books, and you start getting reading, and you start getting university expansion, you start getting the Renaissance coming in. The Reformation, when it comes, makes use of all of this. The doubts regarding the papal's the Pope's ability to do these things, or even the doubts of his own authority, using even political power and pressure to bring about changes in the church. It's some of the stuff that really starts here in the reign, if you will, because there's no other way to really talk about it, the reign of Pope Innocent III. And so, yes, sir.
Up to that point, how long did a council typically meet for?
So, up to that point, there would usually be about month-long events. All of them are completely different. Obviously, if they were really significant ones, they went on for a couple of months. The longest one was the Council of Trent, but that wasn't until the 1500s. That started in 1546 and ended, oh man, it was something like 12 years. Yeah, the dates in my mind are a little fuzzy on that. Right in the center part of the 1500s there. I think it was 1564 when it actually released. Regardless, I'm probably getting that dyslexic somewhere in there. But yeah, they could go on for years. Usually they would try to relegate themselves to a single, like, summer or something like that, but that did not always work. And it depended on how significant of a council it was. Fourth Lateran Council was significant, but they just came with a laundry list and a big rubber stamp and said, hey, guys, stamp this real quick, would you? 3 days to do the Fourth Lateran Council is insanity. That's never... It was. And that kind of calls into question, you know, who checks if a council is a council? And these are the conversations that will go on. I mean, if it's just a rubber stamp for the Pope, who's actually running stuff here? Well, during Innocent III's reign, everyone is just running stuff. But after that, you get some weaker popes who don't take advantage of that kind of power and let things go to seed. And what happens with that? How does that work? And it's a lot more complicated than something easy. Yes. Right. A very unusual circumstance to have a pope retire. I think it's only happened 3 times.
So I'm guessing that Innocent the Third passed in 1216.
Yes, he did.
Was that a natural cause?
Yes. So far as we know. I mean, how much can you actually know? Yeah, there was no et tu, Brute moment or anything like that. So, far as I'm aware, it was by natural, because he was 55, which would be pretty decent for that age and for that time. It wasn't unusual, but a decent age. At that point, 55 was the new 85, so... What's that? Early 1200s, yeah. Yeah, 31, yeah. Average lifespan is a real... Yeah, that's a real dicey thing. That doesn't mean you averagely live to 31. What you want to look at is the terminology of not even average lifespan of those surviving infancy. You actually want to look at average lifespan of those surviving childhood. That'll tell you what you can expect to live as an adult, which you will find that number is significantly north of the average lifespan, like into the 50s, maybe even to the 60s. But so many people were dying as infants and so many children were dying that it just drove... It's not like a 31-year-old is the oldest person in town. That's not how numbers work. Yeah, mid-50s. Yep, that sounds about right. So it would not be unusual. You're not really getting many 90-year-olds or 80-year-olds walking around because, I mean, let's put it this way. If we were living in that time, I would already be dead. Appendicitis would have taken me out this past March. That's it. end of me. So things that we think are simple and can be handled in a couple nights in a hospital or something like that take out people by the droves. We haven't even gotten to 1348 yet. Black Death comes in and kills a third of the world. So that kind of stuff is going to change. And you want to talk about something that changes theology. There's nothing that even comes close. No amount of councils or popes or anything can do the amount that developed in theology in response to the Black Death coming in. Yeah, that we spend an entire night on because it changes everything. Everything. I mean, there were some towns that lost over 50% of the people in like 4 days. How do you... Your society doesn't even work anymore. That doesn't... Yeah. You want to talk about pandemics. That was a horrible 3 years. We are not going to have time to get into Thomas Aquinas. I just want to leave you with my introduction to Thomas, and we will come back to him next week. Thomas Aquinas. I told you when we spent a whole night on Augustine that he was the most influential theologian in history outside of the biblical writers. Thomas Aquinas is number two, and it's not overly close for number three. Augustine looms large in the whole stage of theological discussions. Thomas Aquinas looms almost as large. His writings and his dealings, his training, his ability to systematize and discuss is really second to none. Augustine has great influence, but he's not a systematic theologian on any level whatsoever. But Thomas Aquinas is. And he comes down and talks to Western society kind of more on their level and on their way to speak about stuff, but in a much higher way. And one of the greatest questions that he seeks to establish down for us on theology is the concept of how it is that we know God. If I come up to you and I ask you, how do you know that there's a God? That's not a really easy question to answer, is it? Right? It's complicated. It's got a lot of facets to it. It doesn't even broach the question of how do you know you're worshiping the right God? That's like several steps down the way. Let's just discuss the existence of God, which at this point was a given, and in societies aplenty has always been a given, but we're going to sit down and actually talk about it. What can we know about God? How is it that we know about God? Creation. Very good. That's where you'll start. The natural order. The natural question will come out, what can we know about God from creation? That's the first thing you open your eyes and see, right? Epistemologically, you are taking it in with your senses. You touch things, you taste things, you smell things, you look at things, you hear things. So as you go out into the natural world, what can you learn about God? Right. Order. Yeah. Intricacies. All of these things must be derivatives of God. And so as we go back, we must find out that anything that we see order-wise or intricacy-wise must be lesser than what God is. Things tend towards chaos. That's a great way to go about it. Thomas Aquinas is Aristotelian in mindset, right? So very much natural order concepts. What he'll do is he'll take the Aristotelian concept that there was a prime mover, right? If I am bowling and I throw a ball down the court and it doesn't hit the gutter, one, you can be certain that a miracle has taken place. Also, if you see that ball, and that's the first thing you see is that ball rolling down, what do you have to determine to go back in time? Roll it backwards. Where did it come from? If there's motion, there must have been somebody that pushed it, right? Now, this is all in physical terms, natural order stuff, right? Keep tracing that back. The one who pushed it must himself have been pushed by other things. There must be this cause and effect chain all the way back. When you use the term prime mover, very simple. Here's the statement. If there was a first cause, if there was a first being rolling a ball, if there was a first cause, then the one who caused that, because causes require somebody, was not caused. You see that? It's Aristotelian philosophy proving God by physical means. Am I saying I agree with it? No, I'm describing Aquinas' basic concept of this. We can extrapolate back that because we see things in motion, and we can go back to when they were put in motion, whoever started the first motion, that's God. It must go back all the way to creation, right? Aquinas will look at the world around us, the natural world, and say, how is it that we perceive order or intricacy or movement or something like this? It is through reason. And so we put significant value on reason. Reason that we can see and we can extrapolate that God exists. And by what we see, everything must be derivative from God, so God must be powerful, he must be intricate, he must be orderly. But we reach a limit, don't we, on what we can learn from God from the natural world. In fact, I'll just cheat for a second and use the book of Romans. God has written into the natural world, this is Romans chapter 1, his divine nature and his eternal power. Those things are perceivable just by using our eyes and our hands and our mental faculties and our reason. Aquinas argues the same. This is why you do not come across any society anywhere ever that is atheistic. They've never existed. Every single culture in history has a theology of a creator on some level or another. We have to explain how all of this is orderly, how all of it has intention, and how consciousness and everything else can work. Every single culture has always come back with the same answer: God. Atheistic cultures design themselves out of theistic cultures and kill themselves. We see this happen over and over and over again. It's how cultures kill themselves, is they forget God. It's happened several dozens of times. But you do not get cultures arising out of atheism. It doesn't work like that. They take what they have and they kill it. And this is what Thomas Aquinas is saying, is you must extrapolate from reason and from nature that there is a God and that God is powerful. But you and I both know, as Christians, that's not the only source of knowledge about God. If that was the only source of knowledge about God, we're kind of bumping around in the dark, right? With a tiny little candle that's not really helpful to seeing what in the world's going on. Not only do we have reason, we have revelation, which the natural order is actually part of. But we also have specific revelation in the Word of God. You will not pull, I promise you, from the created world that God is a Trinity. You know why I can promise you that? Because nobody has ever extrapolated that in any society that does not already have the Bible. Nobody's ever extrapolated that. Nobody's ever seen it. It's because God did not write that into the natural order. Everything that we see in the natural order is a lesser version of that. God being one being is three persons. Every being we run into is one being and one person, unless we're talking about inanimate objects, which is one being and no persons. Everything's a diminished version of God, but you cannot extrapolate Trinity out of the created order, right? You cannot extrapolate the incarnation from the created order. That broke rules. An eternal God being born and learning, even though he is wisdom itself. That breaks rules. That breaks natural order. The incarnation, you will not pull out of the natural realm. You will not pull the gospel out of the natural world. You cannot say that living on an island all to my own that I would come to a knowledge of saving faith in Christ Jesus. That's not going to happen without special revelation being told to us directly. That's why scriptures become so important, right? These things are called, to Aquinas, the mysteries of the faith. These are revealed things. They cannot be extrapolated from nature. They cannot come from reason. They are things that God must tell us directly. And so the way he orders it is that while we have reason, our reason is compromised, and God's grace perfects reason. That is one of the founding principles of Aquinas' theology, and it does become one of the most influential concepts in history. Grace perfects reason. I'm sure you've heard about it in terms like this. We all have the image of God, but it is marred, right? It is sick. It is sick with sin or some type of things. And so it is a diminished version of the image of God that we carry. While we carry the value of it, we do not carry the full brightness of it, right? That kind of language is going to come from Aquinas. And it's good language. It's important language. And more than that, it seeks to explain why is it we're in the world the way we are? Why is it we are so dependent on hearing from God? Why is it that we have reason, but it's not sufficient to salvation? These are really important questions to get to, right? Because someone who is insanely smart can just deny the gospel. It's not a matter of how smart you are. It's not a matter of even what culture you're in. It's a matter of God's revelation. And Christ himself will talk about this in the gospel over and over and over again. The same two people can read the same text. One can find salvation, one will not. It's not a matter of familiarity. It's not a matter of something that is just in the natural world. It is something else entirely. And so we will, as the clarity of salvation comes out of the next several centuries, as we work up even to the Protestant Reformation, and the idea that salvation is not a part simply of the natural order and what country I'm in, but it's actually something that must be revealed and intended towards me, that's going to bring a lot of baggage with it. And Aquinas is going to go into the Protestant world, and so is Augustine. And also he's going to stay in the Catholic world, and so is Augustine. And you're going to see these types of things where you have discussions as we go forward, and people are quoting Aquinas, or they're quoting Augustine, and they're actually just lobbing quotes at each other because they both revere these guys. Augustine even more so, right? B.B. Warfield, who was a theologian about 100 years ago, a Presbyterian theologian, said in no uncertain terms, he says, the Protestant Reformation was just Augustine's theology of the doctrine of the church debating with his theology of the doctrine of grace. Augustine had this inconsistency, and the Catholics could throw Augustine's doctrine of the church against the Protestant reformers. The Protestant reformers could throw his doctrine of grace at the church and say, you've lost the gospel, and they say, you've lost the church. And the Protestant reformers are like, I'd rather the gospel. And the Catholics are like, we'd rather the church. And so we are. And so it's a really interesting thing. That's merely an introduction to Thomas Aquinas. We're going to talk about him, Anselm, and some others in the scholastic world, because that becomes a really important thing moving forward, and the thinking and thoughts of those who are learned and experiencing the scriptures, because that is the only place Reformation is going to come from. It cannot come from a people who have never read the Word of God. It's going to have to come from those who are learned. Any questions or thoughts about that? I want you to think about that this week as we prepare to come back for Aquinas next week and some others. Any questions there? No? All right. Well, thank you guys. That was a long trip. Yes, sir.
You believe you're a Christian?
Aquinas? So I particularly shy away from answering those questions because not only is it filled with my own baggage, it is filled with 800 years of distance. I have a hard time knowing the people in my life are Christians or not, based on my own theology. The reality is he was consistent theologically with Christianity as it is. Was he perfect? No, none of us are. Did he claim to have an experience at the end of his life, which is a really confusing thing as well with regards to the importance of it in his own concept? Yeah, it sounded a bit like conversion, but it also sounded a little bit like pietistic mumblings and all sorts of other stuff. So that's a really hard question to answer. If you asked him, he wouldn't understand the question. Of course I am. The sun comes up tomorrow, doesn't it? You're going to ask about that. Everyone would have answered that then. If you're asking whether or not I'll see him in heaven, I have no idea. No idea. I wouldn't be surprised one way or the other. And I say that kind of tongue-in-cheek. I want you to hear a good deal of humility in it, because I'm going to be thoroughly surprised by who is and who is not in heaven. There's going to be a lot more people there without known names than any of us imagine. We study church history based on what can be seen in the physical, natural world. We cannot study the invisible church. We don't know who in the world they are. We're even told in Scripture to consider our own and challenge our own claim to being part of the faithful, to see if our calling and election is sure. I mean, that's our own heart. That's pretty close to us. So if you're just asking my straight-up opinion, I'm about 60-40 yes. How's that? But that's just me with what do I know? I think much more of everyone in this room than I do of him with regards to salvation, because we've heard the gospel as clear as it's ever been preached in history in our generations. He didn't. It makes it a much harder thing to sell. But I have a hard time calling into question Thomas Aquinas. That's going to be a rough call for me. I feel safe calling Augustine yes than Aquinas, but there's many others that I would say absolutely Aquinas would be yes more than they would be. But that's correct. He uses everyone, saint and reprobate alike. And there's, I imagine, a lot of reprobates that have written our theologies over the years, which is a very humbling thought. Thank God for Scripture, because our theologies can go any which way. That's a really hard question to end on. So anyone have an easier one?
Pope Dennis the Third obviously brought a lot of talents within the papacy.
Yes.
What was his development story?
Oh, you're way outside my sphere of expertise with that question. I don't pay attention to popes until they become popes. So before 1198, his backstory to me, I know his name and it's hard to pronounce. His backstory and how he got that way, I do not know. That would be an interesting thing to read about. Yeah, I know. Well, you ask questions that I don't know. So that's, you get punished with homework. Yes.
There's something unique about him.
There is. There is. He would be a very interesting case study. Yeah, quite.
All right, my job.
Yep, that's your job. Sounds great. All righty. Thank you guys very much. Next week, same time, same place.